Good evening, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news. Soft at. Really, all across the country. Thank you. think your term was the bottom of the gene pool?
Yeah, I mean, speaking as an Italian American, I see what I think has happened is second and third generation Italian Americans, the best and the brightest are doctors, lawyers, educators, and the guys that are going under mob today, you're scraping the bottom of the gene pool. I think two generations ago that wasn't the case. The guys like Angelo Bruno in Philadelphia, Carlo Gambino in New York, they were fairly intelligent, fairly sophisticated individuals. They made a wrong career choice in that they decided to become gangsters, but you can almost make, not an excuse, but an
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
can't have this kind of loose, chaotic instability that Molino knows. Cadillac and a van pulls up alongside, and two guys are killed. Thank you. About basically is go-go bars, and the dancers in the go-go bars are supplied. They're usually Eastern European women who are brought over here and basically forced into servitude or prostitution, and they go from club to club and they dance, and these guys are very ruthless and, you know, take the money and brutalize them. I mean, that's one example of what we've seen. Have not seen too much in terms of gambling. There's been a lot of insurance scams, a lot of high-end kind of financial, you know, playing with the markets, that kind of stuff. And a lot of these guys are fairly intelligent. Again, it goes back to what I was saying before. The second and third generation Italian-American gangsters are not. These guys are the first generation, and they bring a level of intelligence and sophistication to, combined with violence, you know, to their operation. And it's all about making money. And it's all about preying on not only your fellow immigrants, but preying on those outside the system who you can take advantage of. I mean, there's been stories of hockey players being extorted. You know, Russian hockey players come over here and play in the NHL. Boxers that are brought over here, they're being extorted. And the threat is, if you don't give us a piece of what you're earning, your family back in the old country is going to suffer. It's very, very nefarious, cutthroat, ruthless, and very, very inhuman. I mean, you can almost make an argument that the American mafia was much more humane in what they did, and that they only went after one another.
All right, no, of course, then, but this is still strongly ethnic. In other words, they're hitting primarily Russians than the general population.
Exactly. I mean, to date, at least, that's the situation, yeah.
And then that's pretty much the same as far as the Asian gangs are concerned.
Yeah, and that's been the history of any kind of ethnic group, if you look at it. And when they first come over and become part of an organized crime organization, it's pretty much self-contained within that ethnic community. and then eventually they'll expand out. What I'm saying is I have not seen the Asians expand out, and I don't know what the Russians will do. It's something worth watching, though.
Well, do you think that things are in pretty good shape, at least as far as Philadelphia? In other words, a lot of little minor criminals running around, but nothing in the way of really organized crime? Or would you say maybe it might be disorganized crime?
It's more disorganized. There's no monolithic institution the way maybe 20, 25 years ago than when the mafia was the dominant player in the underworld. I mean, we've got biker gangs, we've got Hispanic gangs, we've got African-American gangs, we've got kind of a chaotic, unstable situation out there. And I think part of that is because law enforcement has been so effective, and part of it is that no one organization has been able to fill the vacuum created by the demise of the mafia.
Well, what's going to happen to Ron Prevett? I mean, here's a man who has actually testified against the mafia, has sent them to prison, you know, from all points of view. From their point of view, he betrayed them. So why wouldn't he go into the witness protection program and just move off someplace where he would not be such a big target? Because, believe me, he is a big target.
Yeah, you know what? I've asked him about that. I had lunch with him 10 days ago. He's still, as you said, he's still in this area. Basically what he says is he's going to live his life on his terms. He's not going to run. He's not going to hide. And I think that's part of it. I think also I believe part of it is he likes the adrenaline rush of getting up every morning and realizing that there's a certain risk involved in what he's doing. He spent 35 years living life on the edge when he was a gangster and, you know, always having to look over his shoulder, always having to worry about otherwise guys, law enforcement, investigations, whatever. And I think he misses that. And so by staying in the area, he's created the tension that he needs to keep his heart pumping. I mean, he's bored. He's bored with nothing to do. He's like one of these corporate executives. In disarray, and I think you
people pinned down. And
Grazie. Thank you.
do is bring the knowledge of our Lord to the people of the Muslim. Many of them realize there's a conspiracy. They don't really tragically understand that many times it's the God they serve that's behind this conspiracy that we talk about all the time. Anyway, let me suggest that the telephone number is going to be 209-832-0999. That's 209-832-0999. And give them a call. That's Brian Hall's number. You can go to their website at conspiracycon.com. That's conspiracycon.com. And that's the 29th and 30th, and we'll look forward to seeing you there. Well, right now, of course, we're trying to track down Brad Dacus from the Pacific Justice Institute, and I've known Brad for a number of years. He started out with the Rutherford Institute as a young lawyer just out of law school, and giving up the opportunity to make a lot of money to do something worthwhile for the Lord. And when the Rutherford Institute pulled its office out of California, why, he had the opportunity to move back east with him or to stay here and form his own organization, which is what he's done. And Brad offers help to people who are coming under religious persecution, either individuals or organizations, and they provide their service pro bono. He has other lawyers that work with him. And it's so frustrating when something comes up, and, of course, if you want to take a stand for what's right and for the Christian position, and you're faced with massive legal bills, why, a lot of people will back away. Well, the nice thing about what Brad does is he provides the legal care for you, legal recommendations, and he doesn't charge you, his organization doesn't charge you. Now, he's not going to take every case that comes down the line. It's got to fit into certain parameters, but it is so important, in my opinion, that we have organizations like this available. This is what the Rutherford Institute does. That's what certainly the Jay Sekulow's organization does, but here's one right in California, and it not only has cases here, but all across the country, and as time has gone by, why, Brad's organization, the Pacific Justice Institute, really has had more and more of an outreach and is really being much more effective. Well, looks like we're having some difficulty getting Brad, so let's hope he didn't forget about the program this evening. We're going to go ahead and let you go ahead. If you have a question or comment that you'd like to make, why, give us a call. I'll open up our lines at 1-800 or 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. I know that I was deeply touched or moved by what's happened today. I've been very upset by the pictures which were released on CBS 2. That was a week ago last Wednesday. It's been about, almost 13 days since those pictures were released to the world. And I'm firmly convinced that this is being done to inflame the Muslims of the world. And what's happened, you know, is we've given Christianity a terrible name. What we've done is tended really discredit Christianity all throughout the world, and it's not simply in the Muslim world, it's in Europe. We're turning everybody against us. This is the unfortunate thing, and the people who sympathized with America after September 11th, who, you know, felt that we had a right to invade Afghanistan to get Osama bin Laden, and of course, there's a lot of reasons I disagree with our invasion. I think that the Taliban would readily have turned Osama bin Laden over to a third country for trial. They would have expelled him from the country. We could have picked him up. But I believe our government was intent upon going to war. And I believe we were intent upon going to war in Afghanistan not to get Osama bin Laden, but so we could build a oil pipeline across that country. And we needed Osama bin Laden free, because if he was picked up, how would we be able to justify continuing the war on terrorism? And then, of course, this was to be a stepping stone, as it was always intended, for the war in Iraq. And what is really so tragic about the war in Iraq, as we know it was planned by the Project for the New American Century, at least in 1998. And you hear all this discussion now, well, by Condoleezza Rice. Did they decide to go to war in January of 2003 or in March of 2003? And just because the president said, well, we're going to have to go to war in January of 2003, didn't mean that we were going to have to go to war in January. It wasn't until March they made the decision. And ladies and gentlemen, the decision was made long before that. First of all, you need to get my April newsletter, and you will find there quotations from page 96 of the book The Price of Loyalty by Paul O'Neill, who was the Secretary of Treasury. He was the Secretary of Treasury as soon as the Bush administration took office in January of the year 2001, and he tells what happened at the cabinet meetings that were held in the White House in January and February of 2001. That's 7 to 8 months before the 9/11 attack. What were they talking about? Why, Paul Wolfowitz and Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld were talking about going to war with Iraq. And they were wondering how we would justify a preemptive attack. The Defense Department already had a plan laid out how they were going to divide up the oil fields of Iraq. They had the best oil fields and some of the smaller ones, and who they were going to share them with, and how we were going to divide them up. And Paul Wolfowitz wanted to, arm a group of people in Iraq, and then we could send our forces in to help the group that we had armed that was going to overthrow Saddam Hussein. Of course, Donald Rumsfeld thought that, well, maybe we get one of our planes. If one of our planes was shot down, maybe the American people would be willing to go over with Iraq over that. Ladies and gentlemen, they were planning this war 8 to 9 months before the 9/11 attack. at least January and February, but we know from their website, which is newamericancentury.org. That's newamericancentury.org. You can find it on the Internet, and you'll find that this little organization, originally of 25 people, including Donald Rumsfeld, Dick Cheney, Paul Wolfowitz, John Bolton, Liddy, the man named Liddy, Gary Bauer, William Bennett, Norman Potteroats, Frank Gaffney, 25 of the 25 original members of this group, why 17 of them came from the Council on Foreign Relations. So this is a CFR front organization, and its purpose was to put together an international order to protect our security, our profits, and our principles. That's their statement. That's not mine. Don't get angry with me for saying that. That's what they said in June of 1997 in their statement of principles. It's on their website. If you can't get it, we'll be glad to send it to you if you give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. So give us a call, and we would, of course, love to get your views on this. Then it was the following year, in 1998, I believe it was about June, when the PNAC, the Project for the New American Century, sent a letter to President Clinton demanding that we change the regime in Iraq. Now, what they were advocating in 1998 was a war with Iraq. But what was this really all about? Well, in the year 2000, they released a report entitled Rebuilding America's Defenses, in which they said it really doesn't matter about the regime of Saddam Hussein. The requirement for American troops stationed in the Middle East transgresses, I guess, or something. Anyway, it's beyond the regime of Saddam Hussein. Now, that's on page 14 of that report. You need to get it. You need to read it. They talk about how we're not going to be able to redo our military as we want to, unless, of course, there's a catastrophic and catalyzing event like another Pearl Harbor. That was their words. Unless there's a catastrophic and catalyzing event like another Pearl Harbor, you need to find out that these people plan to have our troops stationed all over the world. There was going to be a Pax Americana, and we were going to become the new Rome and dominate the world. Well, I don't think that this is what we should be doing. I think we're going to antagonize the world. We know that when Rome did that, the whole thing fell apart. And I believe that this is all being done to antagonize the world as a prelude to the war, as a prelude to the New World Order and the New World Religion, because unless this country has been horribly destroyed, unless there's been terrible pain and suffering and destruction, the average American is not going to want to give up his sovereignty. He's not going to give up his constitutional protections of individual freedom under God, and until the war is fought, they're not going to be able to create this one world government that these people plan. Now, where do these ideas come from? Well, I believe that we're following a script. I believe we could have taken Saddam Hussein out in 1991, but it wasn't time to do it at that time. I believe that there is, whether George W. Herbert Walker Bush understood it or not, he was motivated by the prince of this world to follow the script that was laid out. And those of you who have heard my discussions with William Sneblin, who was deeply involved in Masonry and in the Illuminati, who was himself a Satanist, he'd come, of course, out of witchcraft and gone into Masonry and gotten into the upper echelons there. And I've talked to him on a number of occasions about his experience and his contacts with a man named Manly Palmer Hall. Now, Manly Palmer Hall, when he died, it was cited in the Scottish Rite magazine as the greatest of all Masonic philosophers. And I believe he was. He was a Satanist. And if you read his books, it's very obvious he was a Satanist. And according to William Sneblin, why Manly P. Hall was the man who was schooling him in Satanism. And in the early 1980s, Manly P. Hall told William Sneblin about the first Gulf War, and that there would be a second Gulf War. According to Sneblin, Hall said that it was planned for the year 2002, and that associated with that Saddam Hussein then would launch a chemical or biological warfare attack on the United States. Now, of course, the war didn't start until 1993, and Saddam Hussein has not yet launched a chemical or biological attack on the United States, although I'm sure that there are chemical and biological weapons. I believe that they were moved into Syria, and I believe that they're there now, and you can go up and look on the Internet under chemical and Saddam's weapons and Syria, and you'll find that there are sites, websites talking about that. I know that at one time we had a man named Dore Gold as a guest on our program, and he was the former Israeli ambassador to the United Nations. He was very, very well-spoken, very articulate Israeli citizens. And in the course of our conversation, as we were talking about Saudi Arabia, Dore Gold had written a book entitled Hatred's Kingdom. It was a story of Saudi Arabia. In fact, we may still have copies of that. In the course of our conversation, I said to Dore Gold, I said, what about the weapons of mass destruction? I had heard that they'd been moved into Syria. And he picked up on that right away, and he said, yes, we know that they've been moved into Syria. Now, I've been told that by Joel Skousen. I've been told that from several sources. I rather believe it's true. I think probably Saddam's chemical and biological weapons are in Syria. And perhaps our administration will suddenly find them in October, sort of an October surprise to rally people behind the president if his polls are falling. I believe that whether they're ever going to be used against America, I have no idea. But I really tremble for my country when I reflect that Saudi Arabia has nuclear tip weapons. The Pakistanis have nuclear tip weapons and missiles. Of course, they got their missile technology from communist China. But, you know, we are simply one heartbeat away, one bullet away from the radical Islamic movement controlling Pakistan and controlling the nuclear weapons that are there. Musharraf is simply bought and paid for by the billions of dollars we've given him. I'm sure he salted a lot of this money away, but he's hated by the people there, and I really fear that if one of these attempted assassinations of Musharraf is going to succeed, and at that point the country will be taken over by radical Islamists, and the nuclear weapons that Pakistan has will be in their hands. They have certainly ballistic missile technology. Whether they have intercontinental ballistic missiles or just intermediate range, I'm not certain, but I believe that they can always buy the long-range missiles from China, which got their technology from North Korea, which got their technology from communist China, which got their technology from Laurel, which got their technology from the United States. We have created this monster. We have transferred our technology to communist China, that transferred it to North Korea, that may very well transfer it to Pakistan and to Saudi Arabia to be used in the coming war, because nothing that the communist Chinese or the Russian communists would love more than to see our cities in smoking ruins. And of course, they didn't do it at all. It was those nasty Muslims that did it. And that, of course, would leave the Russians and the Chinese as the major forces in the world. I don't know what's going to happen, but I believe that we are looking at terrible, terrible times in the not-too-distant future. And I think that people who are in the know realize that we are going eventually, and perhaps not in the too-distant future, to have a nuclear attack on America, because we have no defense against a nuclear attack. We have intentionally, unilaterally disarmed, destroyed our anti-ballistic missile system, put such requirements on the building of an anti-ballistic missile system that we know it won't work. The Russians have a system that will work and work very efficiently because they have small nuclear warheads on their anti-ballistic missile systems. That's what we had in 1970. We knew how to build a system in 1970. But in the year 2004, 34 years later, we have no idea how to build a system that works. And if you believe that, you believe anything. We're in real trouble, ladies and gentlemen, because the leaders of this country, the dark forces that control the leaders of this country, have left America defenseless in a very uncertain world. And now is the anger and the hostility of the Muslim world is raised against us. And believe me, I haven't seen anything yet, but I really believe that we're on the verge of some terrible and difficult times. This is why it's important that you know the Lord, because we can make all of our preparations, and we would be foolish not to make the preparations. Financially, as far as preparation with food and supplies and medical supplies, but in the final analysis, the only thing that is going to see us through what lies ahead will be the Lord. Well, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295, because we seem to have lost our guest for this evening. Brad Dacus was supposed to be with us from the Pacific Justice Institute. So I'm going to ask, if you have a question or comment on what I'm talking about or anything else you'd like to talk about, give us a call at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. And I see a red light on the screen. Hi, is this Brad Dacus?
This is me. How you doing, Dr. Stanley?
I'm doing fine. I'm just sure glad to get you. I was just about running out of things to say.
I don't think I'll ever see that day.
All right. How are you doing tonight?
Oh, doing just great.
Well, tell us what's happening on the front that you're fighting this battle. Because in many ways, you're involved in the same spiritual battle that we're involved in, but you're fighting it from a judicial and legal point of view. So tell us what some of the things that are happening.
Oh, certainly, Dr. Montes. One of the most real aggressive matters that we've dealt with recently has been dealing with a school district called the Westminster School District in Southern California. The majority of the school board are pro-parent, pro-family type school board members. And as you know, there was a law passed in the Davis administration where they went ahead and decided to give special protections to transsexuals in public schools, both students and teachers. Well, this school board said, well, that may be, but we're not going to give into a broad interpretation of this law, which will allow students to, or teachers to suddenly decide that they're going to switch their genders one day and dress like the opposite gender and then, you know, switch it again and use their opposite restrooms and the whole nine yards. They said, this is ludicrous. We're not going to do it. And so they went ahead and said they had a very narrow interpretation of the law. They were threatened by the teachers' unions. They were recalled. The teachers' union, the CTA, of course, as you know, is a real big proponent of anti-family measures. And then but they went ahead and stood their ground, and we gave them advice and counsel. We worked with their attorney and really shored them up. And they did what was right. And as it turns out, the State Superintendent of Public Instruction, Jack O'Connell, decided to go ahead and acquiesce and not to challenge what the school district did. So it was a real nice victory, one that we hope other school districts will follow as far as policies are concerned.
Well, that sounds really great. Now, what about the people that Arnold Schwarzenegger has put into key positions in government? Are they more or less friendly or antagonistic to the pro-family position that you and I would take?
That I don't know, because I know the State Superintendent of Public Instruction is separately elected, and Jack O'Connell, as it turns out, has been much more moderate than his predecessor. But
No, wait a minute. The predecessor was Delaine Easton, wasn't she? And she,
right.
She was really way out. So when you say this is much more moderate, you mean much more towards the middle of the road than towards clinging to the far left by her fingernails.
Yeah. He is definitely to the left. But when you compare it with Delaine Easton, anyone will come out looking much more reasonable. And so that's what we have with O'Connell. So we're pleased about that. But as far as Schwarzenegger's administration itself, the verdict's still out, and we're not sure what's going to end up coming down. He's appointed different people to positions like the mayor of former mayor of San Francisco, and others that we raise eyebrows on. But others say that he's just doing this as a political maneuver to try to come across as having a real broad base.
And yeah, but has he put in anybody who would be there to counter this fellow who so far, this is for our listeners out there, the mayor of San Francisco is the fellow who's going along and encouraging the gay marriages in San Francisco in violation of the state law. So what was he appointed to?
What was he appointed to?
Right.
I can't remember, actually.
Well, anyway, he was appointed to some sort of a gubernatorial commission.
Right, right. It was a commission position is what he was appointed to. And there were some conservatives appointed to it also.
Well, so that's a good sign.
So it looks like, I think it was a political strategy to try to come across as the politician who is has very broad and is willing to get input from everyone.
Hold that thought for just a moment here. We've got to bring our stations back. Well, this is Dr. Stan, our guest this evening. A long, long lost guest is Brad Dacus from the Pacific Justice Institute. And we're talking about the legal problems he is dealing with through his organization that deal with the pro-family or pro-Christian or pro-moral position. And it's so important we have somebody out there. So pick up the story from there, Brad.
So anyway, as it turns out, so Schwarzenegger, the verdict's still out as to what he's going to do, what he's going to become. He has a mixed bag of people he's appointed from the left and from the right. So we'll just have to wait and see. But as far as the school district that we were dealing with before, Westminster School District, that's a real important case matter because these school board members were being threatened to be recalled. The teachers' union was being just outright vindictive. They were boycotting in front of their offices. I mean, just being really ruthless. And yet the majority of three school board members who are Christians, who are, you know, concerned parents, they decided to hold their ground, to do what they knew was right, and in the end they won. And that is a major victory. We provided them with some great legal counsel, and it was their courage, it was their individual courage and stamina that really won the day. Now, the latest battle in this with the school district is dealing with the fact that they want to require written parental consent before any instruction dealing with sexuality. And the law in California only requires notice to parents. And so they said, well, that's fine. That's what the law requires. We want to require even more. We want to require written parental consent. Well, Sheila Kuehl and the left, the legislators, are saying, no, that wasn't the intent. The intent of the law was to prevent school districts from making sure parents know about it, make sure that parents give consent. So they're really, you know, they're sort of shooting themselves in the foot by making it real clear to everyone what their full and true intent was, which was to undermine the rights of parents. But we're very confident the school district is correct.
Well, of course, the other thing is they not only want to conceal the truth from the parents, they want to destroy the moral fabric of their children. That's what it's really about. And until people understand that they know exactly what they're doing, they want to destroy the embarrassment.
Right.
They want to destroy the modesty. They want to destroy the things that take away, that make childhood, you know, so real. And, of course, promote promiscuity, because this is how you demoralize a society. And that is what this is really all about.
Well, absolutely, and they want to see homosexuality flourish, and not just homosexuality, but other forms of sexuality as well, like transvestitism, transsexualism. So that's their goal. They want to do it, and the easiest way for them to do it, of course, is, you know, is to take over the public schools and make sure parents don't know about it. Well, when you have a school board like Westminster, where they're saying, "Hey, wait a minute, we are pro-parent school board." Pro-parent school district, we're going to make sure parents know exactly what's going on by requiring written parental consent, then that sort of puts a kink into their agenda. And so we're just really hoping that other school districts will do what Westminster is doing. And of course, we at the Pacific Justice Institute provide expert legal counsel to any school district wishing to contest what the liberal CTA is telling them that they have to do.
And, of course, there are not very many school districts with that stalwart a school board, are there, though? You know, to find three Christians on a school board is pretty unusual. I know that the left has targeted the school boards because they knew if they could control the school boards, they could control the minds of the children. If they could control the minds of the children and corrupt them, then they could corrupt the next generation. They know exactly what they're doing. And I know when we've tried to run people for our school boards here, they've spent fantastic sums of money to get their candidates elected. They do this all over the state. So, you know, working with the schools, have you found very many that have the courage that these people have?
Well, not many, but we have found a number out there.
Okay.
Sometimes I'll be speaking at a church or something, and which I do a lot of now on Sunday mornings, and one of the members of the congregation is a school board member, and they'll come up and they'll give their appreciation and glad to know that we're here to help them. And so they are out there. They're often not in the majority. That's the problem.
Well, then what we need is more Christians who are willing to get involved, and whether you've got children in the public schools or not, we ought to try to do the best we can for those children who are in the public schools, and Christians should be involved. They should be running for school board, and other churches and other Christians should help them. That's the thing. The trouble is that so often when you run for these positions, why you find yourself all alone.
Oh, absolutely. But there's some school districts that, like Grossmont down in San Diego County, they've taken over their school board completely. And so we see wonderful examples. It just takes people, you know, with determination and bonding together politically and really making a difference. And it can happen.
It can happen because we're the majority, they're the minority. The trouble is they're organized. And we're conservative. We're so conservative, we just don't want to spend any time trying to preserve our way of life. We'll be right back here. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Brad Dacus. We're talking about the battle that he is involved in, the battle his organization is involved in, standing for righteousness here in really a very, very, in many respects, evil state. So tell us about some of your other battles, Brad.
Oh, certainly. Another battle that's taken place involves the ability for courts to come in and dictate how many parents are going to be in a family. What happened is a case involving In re Sharon's was the name of the case, involving two women. They were lesbians, and we'll just say that the first one lady was a lesbian. She had a they both had an agreement that they're going to adopt a baby, and actually no, be conceived. One was going to be conceived with a baby, and then they both had an agreement they were both going to be parents for the baby. Well, before the first lady actually gave birth, she'd conceived through synthetic means. But before she had the baby, she had a born-again experience, gave her life to Christ, and recognized that the life she was living was sinful, was wrong, and broke up with this other lesbian and says, no, I'm not going to do this, and decided that she was going to take her child to church and raise that child with a Christian atmosphere, Christian upbringing. Well, as it turns out, this went to court, and the court decided that not only is this woman bound because of a contract to have this other woman as the parent, but that the court actually has the final discretion as to who's the parent. Thank you.
Thank you. Just Super Talk.